Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, just an ordinary guy. Welcome to another episode of Brains Matter. You've all probably have heard all the news about extrasolar planets being found lately, and no doubt, their discoveries are going to become more and more common. Something that the media never fails to mention when reporting each find is how Earth-like they may or may not be, all in a quest to ask that big question, is there other life out there? On today's show, I visit Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, where John Latanzio, a stellar nucleosynthesis specialist, battles Marian Anderson, a geoscientist, in an International Year of Astronomy public debate on whether intelligent life is common in the universe. What do you think? The debate is hosted by Ali Ford. By the way, both John and Ali have been on the show before, so check out the guest page on the Brains Matter website and listen to those interviews if you haven't done so already. Now on to the debate.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this Monash Research Matters event, which is also part of Monash's International Year of Astronomy activities. Tonight, we're going to be presenting a short debate on intelligent life is common in the universe. My name's Ali Ford. I'm the chair for this evening. I'm a researcher and assistant lecturer in the Centre for Stellar and Planetary Astrophysics, where I look at stellar chemistry, compositions of stars, and mostly focus on astrobiology, the search for life in the universe. On our affirmative side this evening, it's a very large side, we have Marian Anderson from the School of Geosciences. Marian looks at the geochemistry of Yarra Valley billabongs, looks at mineralogy and geomorphology of Mars, including work on deciding landing sites for the current generation of Mars rovers, and she also looks at the early evolution of life. Marian is an advisor to the Victorian Space Science Education Centre, which also has a strong Mars focus. And she has a background in zoology, cell biology and engineering. So she's very well qualified to take on the affirmative side. And our negative presenter for this evening is John Latanzio, who is an astrophysicist for Monash's Centre for Stellar and Planetary Astrophysics. John focuses his research on nucleosynthesis, which is the creation of elements in stars, including some which are relevant to life. John's the director of CSPA. He's published around 200 scientific articles, and he's also a council member of the Astronomical Society for Australia. For those of you who noticed the large microphone being set up, this debate is also being recorded for Brains Matter podcasts, which are a series of science podcasts which are available to anyone through the website. Without further ado, we will begin the debate. The way that we'll go is our affirmative speaker will talk for 5 minutes, followed by a negative speaker, followed by a rebuttal from the affirmative side and a rebuttal from the negative side, and then we'll take a vote to see who swayed you the most. So I will hand over to Marian.
Just one, I assume that when I demolish her argument in under 5 minutes, I'm allowed to add more stuff in.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And when I demolish yours in 2 minutes, I can add even more on top of that. Not a problem.
I just wanted to check.
Yeah, well, you know, demolition being the major thing here. Okay, so where do I want to go? Home. Okay, sorry about people listening, but I'm just putting stuff up. I don't want that. All right, so I'm talking on the fact that intelligent life is common in the universe, and my job is to persuade you that it is. So I'll just turn the lights down a little bit so you can enjoy the ambience of your normal lecture theatre here at Monash. Intelligent life is common in the universe, and I'm going to break this down a little bit and just introduce you to the concept of intelligent life and commonality in the universe for those of you who aren't familiar with what either of those things aren't. And I see some of my first years here, and I think the intelligent bit might be lacking in some of them. No, they're here, therefore they're intelligent. All right, let's have a look at what intelligence is. Intelligence can be defined as three main things: problem-solving, communication, and self-awareness. And as you can see here, these gentlemen are obviously quite intelligent. They have a large brain between them. Other things, however, are able to show some of these qualities: problem-solving, communication, and self-awareness. Let me introduce you to Betty, the New Caledonian crow. Betty is quite a smart crow. she's able to fashion tools out of a variety of different objects in order to solve problems. When presented with a problem, she will go to a whole series of tools, pick the right one, modify it, and use it to get the reward she wants. In the case you can see up the top here, she's found a stick and is using it to prise a beetle out of quite a complicated maze within this brick. In this other one, she's fashioned a hook out of a piece of wire herself and has used it to pull a small beaker here containing a treat out of quite a deep glass vial. This is definitely problem solving. However, Betty, unfortunately, isn't really able to communicate the success of her experiments except with squeaking and squawking and leaping up and down. So communication, self-awareness, she really doesn't qualify. Crows, good at problem solving, but not necessarily good at the other stuff. Okay, this is Alex, now sadly deceased. Alex was an African grey parrot who was one of the best dinosaur descendants at problem solving and communication. He had a huge vocabulary of English language words, which he was able to speak and use in coherent sentences, even developing his own syntax as he went through his life. He was quite good at problem solving. You can see him here selecting things by colour and by number. He was able to recognise the numbers up to 8 before he died. And he was also able to count things like the number of blue blocks and the number of green blocks. So Alex was quite good at problem solving and communication. There was a small amount of evidence that he was self-aware, but this wasn't necessarily 100% proven before he became a Norwegian blue, as in rolled over, belly up. Coco is another example in the animal kingdom. Coco is a gorilla who's been living in the States for quite some time. She is quite able to problem solve. She solves some incredibly complex problems, including how to work out which page of the photo album she wants to look at that particular day. She is able to communicate using a modified version of sign language and has even invented her own signs for things that we don't have a vocabulary for, that humans wouldn't necessarily want to communicate. And she's also self-aware. This is a photograph taken by Coco of Coco in a mirror. And she deliberately set this up with a camera, used it and presented the camera back and was thrilled when she saw the photo. So this is a very, very smart gorilla. So by the three definitions of intelligence, gorillas are it. So should we be looking for more than gorillas out there in the universe? Well, you're here looking at astronomy, so you're probably more interested in this variety of exploration of the universe, where we have humans trundling around on the moon, definitely problem-solving, communicating with a small delay back to Earth, and self-aware because they want to get back to home for their dinner. Okay, we looked at intelligence. Let's have a look at common, the term common. How common is common? We talk about common all the time. This is the Australian common hairy-nosed wombat. In Australia, there are hundreds of thousands to millions of these darling little critters. You see them every time you go for a drive somewhere out in the bush, usually lying by the side of the road with their legs in the air, so their numbers are diminishing. Fortunately, they breed fairly rapidly, so this isn't as much of a problem. For future reference, I'll be using notation where we count the number of zeros and stick it on a 10 to show you the number of these things. So instead of saying hundreds of thousands, I'm going to be saying 10 to the fives. Instead of saying millions, I'll be saying 10 to the sixes, because some of these numbers we're going to be talking about later are very large. Common hairy-nosed wombat, lots of them, very common. This is the common housefly. There are estimated to be on the planet at any one time, depending on the season, anything from millions to billions of these little darlings. So we're talking about 10 to the 6th through to 10 to the 9s of them. This is the common cold. Common cold, now we start running out of space to put the zeros. 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 15 virus particles on average floating around at any one time. So common can vary from, say, 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 15. It's a fairly wide range there. Okay, so we looked at intelligence, looked at common. Let's have a look at the universe. Just in case you need to reorient yourself, this is where we are. We are currently sitting under this bit of cloud here. Hopefully it's not going to rain on me on the way home. Let's zoom out. This is where we are down here. This is our solar system, or out to the Earth. It takes light 8 minutes to get from the sun out to the Earth. This little bit of space here is a tiny little dot in this cylinder here. These are the local stars around us, things like Barnard's star, Alpha Centauri, etc. This cluster of stars here is a fairly insignificant part of our spiral arm of this galaxy. This is our Milky Way galaxy. This entire Milky Way galaxy is this little speck here. within this small cloud of local galaxies which make up this part of the map here. You can see that there are some other galaxies around as well. And all this area here fits into this tiny little speck here, and this much larger area of clusters of galaxies fits into this little bit here, and this is the extent of the known universe out to around about 13.7 billion light years away. So the universe is a very, very large thing. All right. This is astronomy, so I thought I'd put some pictures of stars up. This is looking in at the centre of our own galaxy. And as you can see, there are lots of stars. There are literally billions of stars all over the place heading in towards it. There are also clouds of gas and dust, which obscure even more of the stars. Okay. Imagine you're holding out a 5-cent piece at arm's length. Imagine the amount of space that that 5-cent piece covers in the sky. This photo was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, and apart from these two things that I've circled in red, everything else is a galaxy. And this is that amount of space, the amount of space out there in the sky that would be completely occluded by a 5-cent piece. There are hundreds of galaxies alone in this image. So, intelligent life, universe, common. Let's have a look at a best-case scenario. If we assume one intelligent civilization per 100,000 stars, and John's taking notes here because he likes maths, there are approximately 10 to the 21 stars in the universe, this number of noughts. That's an awful lot of stars. One intelligent civilization per 100,000 stars would give us around about 10 to the 15 civilizations. Worst case scenario, assume that we as humanity are alone in our galaxy and that every galaxy has one intelligent civilization. This still means that there are around about 130 billion galaxies, or 1.3 by 10 to the 11 in the known universe, which means in terms of intelligent civilizations, we're talking about 1.3 by 10 to the 11 intelligent civilizations in the universe. This puts a number of civilizations somewhere between the common housefly and the common cold. Now, I don't think you can deny that either of those things are uncommon, so I think I have proven that intelligent life is common in the universe. Thank you.
So now we'll hand over to the negative side, and John.
I'm not a negative side. I'm not a negative presenter at all. No.
Presenter for the negative.
Yeah, that'll do. Right.
I will now ask John Latanzio to present for the negative.
So science isn't about what you want to be true. It's about what is true. And sometimes that means taking an unpopular stance. So I stand before you to tell you that the things that we most want to be true are not true. It would be really nice to meet and communicate with aliens, but I think intelligent life is uncommon. That's a sad fact, but I think we have to deal with facts. I'm going to give you two arguments here. One is an empirical one, that we haven't found any. And the second one is that theoretically, I think they're unlikely. We all know about SETI, radio searches for extraterrestrial intelligence. They started in the 60s. I did a quick assessment last night of how much has been searched so far. This is by far a lower limit. 1960s, only 11 stars, but two galaxies and two quasars, which is two more galaxies. In the 70s, 1,500 stars and four galaxies and 50 star fields. They didn't say how many stars were in those, but there were 50 star fields. In the 80s, 1,000 stars, no galaxies, and 85 star fields. In the 90s, over 6,600 stars, another four galaxies, and 200 star fields. And so far, since 2000, another 5,000 stars, 25 globular clusters, each one having 100,000 stars in it. This is on top of the survey that just said all sky survey, which ran for 6 months. I don't know how many stars that was, so I didn't even count those. But they've happened as well. In total, this is, as I say, by far a lower limit. 14,000 individual stars have been checked. 10 entire galaxies have been looked at. And millions more stars that I can't quantify. And, of course, they found nothing, or we would have known about it. Jumping ahead to Marion is going to say, but absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And that's very true. But it isn't a good sign. Just because we haven't got evidence for unicorns doesn't mean that we should assume that unicorns exist until we come up with evidence that they don't exist. It's very hard to disprove something. So a serious question is, how long do you keep looking before you say, OK, we gave it a good shot, and there doesn't seem to be anything there. That's the empirical argument. Now if I tell you that in the remaining time that I've got here, I'm going to toss a coin, a fair coin, and I'm going to get 10 heads in a row before Ali drags me off, how many think I'd do it? Right. Well, Marion thinks, because she thinks I'd cheat, right? What if I said I was going to get 2 heads in a row before I finished? Yeah, that's a lot easier. So that'll happen much more quickly. Now let's have a look. Let's apply the same logic to life on Earth. What happened on the Earth? This is a plot of the history of life on Earth. What's the history of the Earth? 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth was formed. First evidence for life, 3.8 billion years ago. I'm going to call that 4 just for round numbers. So 4 billion years ago, the first life appeared on the Earth. So that's here. So for all of that fraction of the Earth's life, Earth's history, there's been life on the Earth. Life has been existed on the Earth for 4 billion years, which is 4,000 million years. Intelligent life? Well, now, we take that previous diagram. If we restrict ourselves to anything other than bacteria, we're only looking at this last little bit here, because it's only in here that animals evolved. So all through this period, we had nothing but bacteria and microbes. We get some animals up here in the last half a billion years. We then expand that down here, and we see that we don't even get mammals until about 200 million years ago. And when did humans appear? 2 million years ago. Now, I know the bird was smart, but I don't think that they're nearly as smart as us. And basically, my definition of intelligence is something I can talk to across the galaxy. So humans don't appear until about 2 million years ago. So intelligent life on Earth only existed for 2 million years. So I ask you, how long is a piece of string? Enter prop. This has been designed to be a graphic illustration. This piece of string is as long as the history of life on Earth. And that little bit there corresponds to how long humans have existed on the Earth. This little piece here. Okay? That's how long humans have existed. Would you like to dramatically unfurl this to represent the history of life on the Earth? So life has existed on the Earth for that long, and only this much of it is even what we would call human hominids. Now, if intelligent life is so common, why did it take so long to get going? The obvious conclusion is that intelligent life is not common. Life arose quickly on the Earth, very quickly. Within half a billion years, we had microbes here. Then it took nearly 4 billion years for that to turn into anything more interesting, you know, like a slug. And it's only in the last 2 million years that we've had something that you could say was intelligent. The dinosaurs were very successful. They dominated the Earth for 200 million years. They weren't very smart. And so, obviously, since intelligent life took a long time to get started, I conclude it's very likely, and the sad fact is, even though we don't like it, intelligent life is rare. Thank you.
So we've heard main speeches for each side. Now it's time for them to start attacking each other, so it could get really interesting. So I will invite Marion to come and present her rebuttal.
Rebuttal. Almost too easy, John. Almost too easy.
Good.
Well, to start with, I can prove that he's hardly a scientist that you can take credibly, because he began his argument with, "I stand before you," when he was obviously sitting. You mentioned the SETI argument, the whole SETI program. Well, the problem is that SETI just simply hasn't been going long enough. There is an awful lot of stuff out there, and whilst they have searched very many things, as I pointed out, you know, even with one intelligent civilization in a galaxy, then, you know, that still gives you what I would consider common distribution throughout the universe, because the universe is very large. SETI is also looking back in time. As you look out into space, the further you look, the more you look back in time. If intelligent life does take a long time to evolve, then the further you look out away from the Earth, the further you're looking back in time, and the more chance there are that the communications you're looking for simply are still on their way here. We haven't got them yet. that they are still somewhere between being emitted and us. So unless something has been around in the past 40 years, 100 years, in terms of light years away from us, then SETI won't actually hear it at this point, unless these things have evolved very close to us. In terms of life evolving elsewhere, yes, we only have one coherent result of it, but we do have a lot of evidence that organic chemicals are incredibly common in space. The Murchison meteorite, which fell in central Victoria, was full of organic chemicals. The evidence from the Stardust probe that brought back samples of cometary dust has proved that organic materials, amino acids, are found in the tails of comets. And so if they're present as the building blocks of things that haven't even formed a planet, then they're very likely to be present in other solar systems as well. So life should be common. Intelligent life, yes, I admit, intelligent life may be rare in terms of not every star will have it, and not every planet around every star will evolve it. In our solar system, we're it. We know that. I doubt very much that the Edgar Rice Burroughs Martians are going to leap out and greet the first people that arrive there, much as I'd like that. That'd be kind of interesting. So the problem is that we only had intelligent life on the Earth for 2 million years. I agree. Which means that anything further away from us than that, if it's evolving at the same time and the same rate that we are, we're not going to hear, we're not going to discover, we're not going to know about it. And we still also have to be listening on the right frequencies. Even if we do send out a signal, hello, we're here, and the closest civilization is, say, 10,000 light years away, and they get that signal 10,000 years from now, and they send back a, oh, yeah, actually, hi, we'd like to talk to you. It's going to be 20,000 years from now. 20,000 years in the past, we were barely literate. We were barely able to construct shelters that weren't caves. So there is almost definitely intelligent life out there. It's just that it's not talking to us. Your turn.
Saying there's almost definitely intelligent life out there doesn't count as a scientific argument, I'm sorry. I'll get to the rare earth hypothesis after I demolish what laughingly passes for Marion's argument. Actually, we're very good friends. I'm only teasing. As I said, I defined intelligence to be something that can communicate with me across a galaxy.
We can't communicate across
a galaxy. Yes, we can. Provided people build the things that we're transmitting, we could.
Transmissions haven't reached the other side of the galaxy yet.
But the galaxy's not dead yet either. I didn't interrupt you, so just shut up. Right. Now, Betsy the cow and Alex the parrot were indeed very clever, and if they build radio telescope arrays, I'll be the first out there to congratulate them. Marion also said that Coco deliberately set up the mirror and the camera. So Marion now has been able to get into the mind of Coco and know whether it was deliberate or not. It may appear deliberate, but to actually assign whether it is or not is really, really difficult, as I'm sure you know. Organic chemicals are everywhere. That's true. I'm not arguing that life is rare. I'm arguing that life is common. I think the example on the Earth shows you. Stick a planet somewhere where it's not too bad, bang, microbes everywhere. Then to get something more complicated is a lot harder, as evidenced by the fact that it took such a long time on Earth. It may never have happened. And then we heard about the SETI timescale. If we send something now, you know, wouldn't be here yet. The galaxy is 3 times as old as the Earth. So if we had been formed in the first generation of stars, first ones with metals, say, but if then we would have been around for 10 billion years by now and we could have sent our radio waves all around the galaxy. I don't buy that argument at all. That just says that no one got started before us. There's plenty of them, but we just happen to be the first or about the first. The last thing I want to discuss is common. And this could be the common ground here. I would consider one intelligent civilization per galaxy to be exceedingly uncommon. That may mean that there's 10 to the 13 in the universe, but it means that there's only one per 100 cubic megaparsecs. You take all of the common cold viruses on the planet, you say that's a lot. It sure is on the planet. Spread them out through the galaxy, through the universe, and they're not very common. There may be a large number, but there's a huge space in between. So if Marion's happy to say that one per galaxy is common, I'm going to say one per galaxy is uncommon, and that could be the cause of our disagreement. I just want to run you very briefly, in my remaining 30 seconds, through this rare earth hypothesis, which was put together by a couple of astronomers a few years ago. They claim that the Earth is very rare. Their arguments are, first of all, it's in the galactic habitable zone. What does that mean? Well, if you get too close to the centre of the galaxy, there are black holes and neutron stars and intense radiation fields and lots of massive stars, and it's not a good place for life to get started. If you're too far out near the edge of the galaxy, then there aren't enough metals to form stars and to form planets. And they estimate that only 10% of the stars in our galaxy are in the right place in the galaxy. You also need a fairly long-lived star. We know it takes quite a while for life to get started. Even if you put fairly wide limits on that, it looks like only about 10% of the billions and billions of stars live long enough. We also need to have liquid water. We need some solvent of something to make the chemicals happen. That means we have what's called the stellar habitable zone. Can't put an estimate on that, but we need that. We probably need, this is something that hadn't been thought about until recently, you need a large planet to divert asteroid impacts. You know the Earth's been hit by asteroids many times. And this is a plot showing some of the extinctions that have happened on the Earth from asteroids. If you've got a large mass in the solar system, like the Sun, it's just going to attract all of the asteroids. And if the Earth gets in the way, you're in trouble. How about putting another mass in there so that on the way in, it's got a chance to be perturbed away by this other mass? Large thing like maybe Jupiter. So the Earth's, our solar system is unique of the ones that we've seen in that it's got all the terrestrial planets inside and a big thing outside. The big thing can't be too close to the Earth or it'll disrupt our orbit and we'll go spiralling into or out of the solar system or into the sun and you won't have any life. So it's got to be close but not too close. We need a large moon. The rotation axis of the Earth is held constant by the presence of a large moon. Take the moon away and the rotation axis swings around on quite rapid timescales, which means that you could suddenly find yourself in summer for 10,000 years and then in winter for 10,000 years. That's not good if you're trying to get complex life going. You need constant conditions. The moon itself was the result of a collision of another body colliding with the Earth. It had to collide at the right angle to leave behind a moon. Not all collisions will work, but only some. So that again becomes a rare event. The size of the Earth's just right. If you make it too small, you can't hold an atmosphere. You need an atmosphere to keep the temperature going in the Earth. So to regulate the temperature, you need to hold on to your atmosphere. If your mass is too small, you can't do that. The Earth is the only rocky planet in our solar system to have a magnetic field. The magnetic field protects you against cosmic rays and many damaging things from space. It doesn't stop all cosmic rays going through, but it does protect you dramatically from if you didn't have any. Plate tectonics. How many people realise that plate tectonics is crucial to life on Earth? This is something that hasn't been known until relatively recently. But it's a way of circulating the CO2, which keeps the atmosphere warm and the greenhouse constant. There's a feedback because you take the CO2 into the oceans and then because of plate tectonics gets subducted under the ground and back up through volcanoes. Other planets don't have that. So I just said that. The other thing we need is the host should be a single star. Most stars appear in clusters. If you have even two stars orbiting each other, trying to put planets around them, the other star perturbs the planets and they either get flung off into space, no heat, or they crash into the sun. So you need a single star. It's about 10% of stars. Well, I've just come up with 9 terms, many of them unknown. If we assume each one's about 10%, we're down to 1 in a billion. If there are 10 billion stars per galaxy, we're down to just a few Earths per galaxy. And there's no guarantee that intelligent life will appear on any of them. That's just getting a planet that looks a bit like the Earth. So, again, I'm forced to conclude that empirically we don't see them, and we've searched quite a lot, and they've had 13 billion years to get going. We haven't seen any. I've given you arguments for why it's rare based on what happens on the Earth and also that the Earth itself is rare. If Marion's going to call one intelligent civilization per galaxy common, then I agree life's common. I don't think one per galaxy is common.
So you've heard the arguments from both sides. The question is, who was the most convincing tonight? So we'll just ask for a show of hands. How many people think that intelligent life in the universe is common?
But some people and some elves.
And how many people think that intelligent life is uncommon in the universe? Oh, it appears that the negative side has won for today.
But, well, that's what we said when we tossed the coin to decide who got what. Marion said, you got the easy one.
Exactly. But I hope you agree that that's been interesting. And firstly, I'd just like to ask you to thank our two speakers.
Now it's time for Listener of the Episode. Today's Listener of the Episode is Kay Walker from Adelaide in Australia. Thanks for listening to the show, Kay. Now back to the debate.
So now we're giving you the option to shoot down the arguments or to ask any questions that you might have about the search for life in the universe and if it's common or rare. So the question is that we've got the elements for life are common and that water is common, but the systems that we've found are mostly hot Jupiters, so large planets close to the star. Given that information, what is the chance of life being found? Was that correct?
Yep. Well, I think we agree life is probably common. I think, and by common I mean more than one per galaxy. But microbial life is very likely to be found elsewhere. I'd be surprised if there wasn't some Europa or Titan or something.
I'm pretty sure there's something weird going on Mars.
That would not surprise us at all. The question then becomes intelligence, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And we deliberately didn't come up with an agreement on intelligence because that would have made the debate.
I'm still not too keen on his, you know, intelligence being able to communicate across the galaxy because I still don't think we can communicate feasibly across the galaxy if we're limited to speeds at the speed of light.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough
that's
too.
That's an information dump.
Intelligent life that we can't communicate with may be fairly common. I mean, it's probably common on the Earth. I remember talking to an astrobiologist once, and I said, "How fascinating would it be to get into the mind of an alien?" And he said, "Well, we could do it every day if we tried." He said, "There are lots of species on the planet we don't try to communicate with."
Yep.
And they have a very alien view of the planet to us.
Yeah, like my mother-in-law.
But I mean, we just don't do that, and it sort of staggers me that we don't. And when someone does, you discover that, you know, Alex can count and knows colours. It's amazing.
Yeah, and swear quite fluently.
So the question, just for anyone listening via Brains Matter, is given that we had quite a negative prognosis from the argument, is it even worth looking?
Well, if we don't look, we'll never find. I mean, it's one of those things where the search itself has brought so many new types of technology, so many new types of science, and so many new discoveries just in itself, that just looking for terrestrial planets, even hot Jupiters, has changed what we know about solar systems, about how they evolve, the formation of it, like the planets that were spotted and reported a couple of weeks ago now, which actually revolve backwards around their stars. We'd never known such a thing was possible because we hadn't found it before. And with the Kepler telescope out there, which will soon be sending back way more information than we can deal with, looking for more and more potentially habitable planets and looking at the spectrum of the atmospheres of those planets, looking for things like oxygen, like methane, some more complex molecules and signs of life. That is going to be very interesting. The next 10 years are going to be the make or break for life in our solar system and around other solar systems.
Can I just say, I agree, it's worth looking. The question is, how many resources do you put into it? And I don't have an answer for that. A good counter-argument to SETI, I think, is that most of our communications are now going back to cable, and so the period when we used radio communications could be as short as 50 years. If that happens elsewhere, then we're screwed completely because there's only a 50-year blip somewhere, one per galaxy, that we're trying to find, and that's not likely to happen. I also wonder, 50 years from now, will humans look anything like they do now? We're merging with electronics and biologically changing so much that I think our entire view on what sort of things we find interesting will be different 100 years from now than they are now. We'll be able to live arbitrarily long times. We'll have nanobots in our bloodstream clearing them out so that, you know, vascular disease is a thing of the past. What sort of things will we be interested in then? Will we really want to build a radio telescope with some old technology to talk to something else? I don't know. And a civilization a billion years ahead of us, are they likely to keep an old radio telescope around because they know that's the first sort of thing that you think of? If all the humans disappeared, I'll shut up in a minute, but if all the humans disappeared, this is another thing that Charlie Lineweaver said to me, and I wish he hadn't because he's worried me. If all of the humans disappeared off the planet tomorrow, where is the evidence that there is another species ready to take over using tools and technology? There isn't any. Using a stick is very good, but it's nothing like a 747. And he believes, and I'm not sure that he's right, but I haven't got an argument against him, he believes that our use of technology is something that's specific to this species, and there's no reason to think that any other species anywhere in the universe would use technology like we do. And I wish I had a good argument against that, because if he's right, there's no point building radio telescopes or looking.
Yeah, but the other argument to that has always been the cost of these things. And people say, oh, yes, but, you know, look how much it costs to build a new radio telescope and all that. And there's a really good rebuttal against that, which I occasionally use when people say, oh, yes, but look how much it costs to send a probe to Mars and you're not going to find anything, so why are you bothering to look? You know, the mobile phones and the ringtones on them and the really annoying things, and you can buy new ones and, you know, transfer them across and all that sort of stuff, and you can pay money for them. The global industry last year in mobile phone ringtones was almost $7 billion. Okay? I can't think of anything more useless than paying money to change a ringtone on a mobile phone in terms of developing society, other than perhaps stopping your spouse killing you because your ringtone's annoying. But, you know, yeah. No, if the people of the planet Earth are prepared to spend $7 billion changing a ringtone on a mobile phone, then there should be no arguments whatsoever against SETI or Mars probes or sending humans out into the solar system.
So the question is that given that the metallicity of stars has been changing over time, gradually increasing, and there's a possibility that we're one of the first civilizations, intelligent civilizations to arise.
Well, is it possible? Is it likely?
Is that likely?
Yeah. But in terms of raw amounts, even very metal poor stars have got enough. But the question is, how do you get that? Can you get that to form into the planets? It seems like early on when astronomers use the word metals to mean anything other than hydrogen and helium. So it doesn't necessarily mean metals. It could mean oxygen and magnesium, things that make rocks very nicely. Early on, there were a lot less of those. They also affect star formation and how you form stars. You need more of these things to cool the gas and make stars form. So having very low metallicity means that forming stars is harder, forming planets is probably harder as well. There's that effect. There's also a pretty good argument that you may have heard of gamma ray bursts. The gamma ray burst were to go off within about 100 parsecs of the Earth, it would kill everything on one side of the Earth. No doubt. Some stuff on the other side would probably survive. Fortunately, these are very rare. Now, they were not rare in the early universe. And one of the arguments is, if you calculate how frequently these things are from the distribution of their appearances in space, and if you assume that any planet within 100 parsecs of one of them gets sterilized, then it's only in the last billion years or so that you would start getting, in the last, no, 1 billion years older than us, yes. In the last 6 billion years, that you start to get these events being sufficiently rare that life can get started. That's some estimate, I mean, and there's uncertainties in it. But that is an interesting thing too. So there are various ways you might be able to wriggle to say that the early universe just wasn't suitable.
Can I ask how much the known universe is growing? All these arguments about intelligent life depend on how big the universe is. And I'm not sure we know how big it is. We only know how big the known universe is. And I'm wondering how...
That will always be true.
I'm wondering if it's the unknown unknown.
That's right.
I'm wondering how that is... We're discovering that the universe is bigger and bigger, and we're continually discovering that. And is that known universe getting bigger and bigger as time goes on? And are we discovering that it's really very, very big universe?
I just don't buy that argument at all, because something that's in another galaxy is just so far away that in practical terms, it might as well not be there. So I don't... This is why I concentrated on our galaxy. And again, we didn't raise that because it, you know, doesn't give you much wriggle room if you say life in the galaxy as opposed to life in the universe. But if there's intelligent life in another galaxy, that is so far away that in practical terms, it might as well not be there.
Yep. By the time we discover it's there, it'll be too late to do anything about it anyway.
Sure, I know.
Yeah.
So, but to think that there might be intelligent life
somewhere. That's the whole wish fulfillment thing, you know. This is why people search for it. It's the hope, it's the dream, it's the whole, you know, it might be out there somewhere, but whether it's going to come down and tap you on the shoulder and say, hi, here's a secret to life, the universe and everything, you know, it's a very different thing.
My take on it is that there's all these very rare events you're talking about, but if there's the chance that these rare events are repeated over and over and over and over and over again, many millions of times,
it has to be more than billions, though, because
yes,
even if it's 10%, you get one per galaxy. I would say that it's almost certain there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, but from a practical point of view, that doesn't affect us unless it's in our galaxy. Even in our galaxy, it's going to be pretty hard.
If it was in our nearby spiral arm neighbourhood, then it gets interesting. But other side of the galactic core, you know, forget it.
Actually, just before you take another question, one of the videos that I showed the first year course has a quote from some philosopher, and I can't remember his name, but he says, with so many worlds, if they're uninhabited, what a waste of space, which is where they got the line from for the in Cosmos. And then he says, and if they are inhabited, what scope for folly? Fantastic line.
So the question is, most of the arguments are coming from a sample of one. We know that there's life on the Earth. It's the only planet we do know there's life on at the moment. What's the scope for life under different conditions?
Basically,
you go first, I went first.
Unknown. There's been all sorts of hypotheses about life evolving on gas giants and that type of thing. But again, it's primarily microbial type of life. As John suggested, and I agree with him 100%, you need to stress bacteria to get them to evolve. To stress them, you need to put them under constantly changing conditions. One of the reasons that virtually nothing happened on Earth for the first 3.6 billion years, or give or take a bit, of history, was that the Earth didn't change much. There were plates moving around a bit and rearranging, but it wasn't until you got a massive amount of oxygen in the atmosphere that things really started getting kick-started. And it was that stress and the constant response to stress that caused evolution, that really triggered an evolutionary arms race that led eventually to us and what we're doing to the planet. If you have another type of planet, gas giant, ice planet, whatever, unless you have constantly changing environments, whatever evolves on it won't be stressed, which is why I'm absolutely sure that if we do find life on Mars, it's going to be bugs. It's going to be, and by bugs, I'm not talking about creepy, crawly things with way too many legs. I'm talking about bacteria, really basic archaea-style life, because not much has happened there for the past 3 billion years. So whatever evolved there, if it's still there, it's been hanging on, just doing what it does, reproducing perhaps once every 20,000 years, 30,000 years, and that's boring. But it certainly hasn't been stressed and constantly changing stresses that would trigger that evolution. So, yes, you know, it's possible that you could have life evolving in the tops of gas giant clouds, as I think it was Arthur C. Clarke postulated in some of his novels. Certainly, I don't think unless you've got that constantly changing stress, you're going to get intelligence. We've already done it. The first things that went to the moon, the first things that went to Mars weren't sterilised. We have bacteria from Earth on the moon and on Mars. I don't know if they're thriving, I don't know what they're doing, but the common cold virus survived on the moon for at least 2 years and came back quite viable in total vacuum and intense ultraviolet light. On Mars, like I said, the first probes that went there that either landed safely or crash-landed were not sterilised, not to the level that we're sterilising them now. And so, you know, we have already seeded other planets.
Not deliberately.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that, you know, sure, we can send viruses to Mars or to the moon or anywhere else. But again, unless it's stressed, it's not going to do anything. It's just going to sit there and survive, and that's it.
Yeah. You could send up a rude message every now and then.
Put an electric current through them.
In the search for extraterrestrial life or any other communicable life out there somewhere, given that many years back we didn't know how to use electricity or radio waves or radar and other forms of communication that we know about now and are quite common and useful, is it not possible that we can yet discover a different form of communication that we can then
absolutely
lock onto and find, hey, there is something going on, something faster than the speed of light, whatever, you know, something different?
It's certainly possible that there's something else that is much better suited that we haven't discovered. Done about this faster than light stuff at the moment, we think that's impossible. But anyway, there may be something else that's much better suited that we just haven't thought of yet.
Yeah.
And so we're completely wasting our time with radio waves.
Yeah,
certainly possible.
Well, the problem is that until we can conceive of them, we can't look for them. You know, it until people started listening to communications transmissions using radio, we weren't actually aware that the gas giants emitted radio waves. And so, you know, that was basically when people first started looking for signs of life. It was first thought that the signals that came from Jupiter could have been radio messages from another civilization.
Yeah.
And they weren't. Well, not that we know of, or if they are, they are so random we can't pick up any message in them.
Mm.
But, you know, trying to conceive of something that doesn't exist would be like being, well, you remember when your standard cassette tapes first came out, and this was kind of the be-all and end-all, you know, this was great, you know, made LPs almost redundant because you could copy them onto these things and they didn't warp in the sun, well, not quite as much. But trying to conceive of compact discs then and solid-state memory at that point was almost impossible. So, you know, it's that vision. Until you have that breakthrough, it's really hard to see what the next big thing is going to be. If you can predict the next big thing, you'll have made enough money to be able to fund the search for the next, you know, 200-300 years.
That's still possible.
Oh, everything's possible. I mean, it's possible that someone's trying to talk to us using tachyons right now, but we're just not listening on the right wavelength.
You know, there are these nutters that believe in crop circles as messages. And I mentioned this in the first year astrobiology subject as, you know, it's completely crazy. Why would you come from the other side of the galaxy to come out here and draw circles in the crops? In fact, I know a guy who does it as a joke, you know. But then I was thinking, I thought, you know, that's probably exactly the sort of thing that an alien intelligence would do. Something that, what the hell is that? You know, are you kidding? That doesn't make any sense. That's more likely.
Well, it's a test for us. If we're smart enough to understand them, obviously, yeah, we're worth talking to.
So, Michael Archer, and so did Martin Ryle, said that the plaque on the Voyager spacecraft was a big dinner invitation. It said, come to Earth, we've got lots of lovely things to eat. And Michael Archer said anything that we're likely to meet in space is likely to be an intelligent super predator like us and very likely to want to come and attack us. I mean, it's a pretty expensive way to get a meal to cross the galaxy, you know? There've got to be better ways. I just don't buy that as a danger at all. If you got one question of an alien civilization, what would you ask them?
And are you hungry?
Richard Dawkins said he would ask, no, it wasn't Dawkins, it was the other guy. Anyway, the other biologist, I can't remember. Anyway, he said he would ask, what's your biochemistry? Because that's the one thing that we can really learn dramatically from another species. And I went with that until recently. I think now I'd ask them, have they matured beyond fart jokes? I like to hope that someone has. There are books that try to push our imagination and yet remain constrained by what we know. And I read one of these and the guy concluded, he said, I think if we met something, we'd pretty much likely know which where to look. It's likely to have eyes. It's likely to have stereo vision. It's likely to have, in fact, he argued that it would have two eyes, because the amount of brain power involved in processing is enormous. If you're going to have a lot of eyes, that becomes a serious burden, unless they're not very good. And there are reasons why you would want something. Most of the more intelligent things on Earth are sort of similar size. Okay? I mean, the microbes are not smart, and we don't have anything. You know, the dinosaurs are about as big as anything on Earth's ever gotten. They weren't particularly smart. There are biomechanical reasons why life's more likely to be of a particular size, given the gravity of the planet. You constrain your scale. And people have tried to push these things as far as possible. But it's very hard. You can always come up with things that seem plausible. People talk about silicon-based life. Well, that yes, you know, you can replace a lot of the reactions using oxygen with silicon. But one of the things, if you try to respire like we do, then instead of breathing out carbon dioxide, which is a gas and it's fairly easy to get rid of, you'd be breathing out silicon dioxide, which is sand and is a solid, and it's nowhere near as easy to get rid of. Yes. So if you're a nascent life form, it's a lot easier to use oxygen than silicon. So there are reasons why we go looking for things like the Earth, and it may mean that we may well be wrong, but there are reasons why we're forced to it. It's not that we haven't looked at other things.
Yeah, but I'm really, really looking forward to being surprised.
Yeah.
I hope sometime in my lifetime I am definitely surprised by these things. And like I said, I think the next 10 years are going to be absolutely full of stunning discoveries, one way or another.
We tend to define intelligence to be the things that humans do well.
Yeah. Mm. Now, I think that, again, this is one of those things where you really have to push the boundaries of your own imagination. And it's very, very hard to get funding from governments to do research that really pushes the boundaries that far, to try and search for things that we're not using in ways that we're not doing things. It just gets bounced every single time. You just can't put the grants in. They get laughed at. So we're kind of constrained to some extent by funding and the way funding is put together, that if you want to get money for a search for anything, you've got to search for something that the grant givers are going to conceive of as being likely to be found or even possible to be found. If you say that you're going to search using a whole new variety of technology, which is going to take 50 years to develop and may or may not actually function, then you're not going to have very much funding to do it.
Okay, on that note, we'll conclude the formal proceedings. But before we go, can I ask you to thank our speakers again?
And I'd just like to wish you a safe journey home, wherever that home may be, and please try to avoid the crop circles and the low-flying saucers.
I hope you enjoyed that debate for IYA09. I'll leave you the quote from Voltaire. The art of medicine consists in amusing the patient while nature cures the disease. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right hand side. You can listen to the episodes from your browser by choosing Flash Player from the links and selecting whichever episode you want to hear from within the player. There's also other information on the site, such as links to articles and news, subscription details, both via iTunes and manually, and voting information. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now. Yeah.